O'Reilly Media's Sarah Payton interviews Steven Johnson. This legendary San Francisco Bay Area photographer abandoned film over a decade ago to explore the digital frontier. Since then, his pioneering fine art landscapes from around the world have been widely collected and brought him international fame. Steven talks to us about his new book, Steven Johnson on Digital Photography, his career, photo techniques, and how as an opinionated young man with a passion for the outdoors, he fell in love with taking pictures.
How are you today, Stephen?
I'm doing fine, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So I wanted to talk to you a lot about your career as a photographer, and I think we all want to know, what inspired you to become a photographer?
Well, it's kind of funny. I never really set out to be a photographer. I think what happened was photography happened to be one of those areas that once I reached college age was a combination of interest areas that I really never anticipated as a career. I had always loved being outdoors and, in fact, had grown up in a family of deer hunters, but at 13, I became a vegetarian, so that excuse for being outdoors was no longer really in place. But I started backpacking when I got a driver's license and started just enjoying the outdoors on a whole other kind of term. And when I think back to my youth in general, I had always been fascinated by technology, whether it was the space program or science fiction and Star Trek and things like that. So that sense of what technology could possibly enable was always a part of where I came from in my head. I was always taking things apart and putting them back together and figuring out how they worked. And that was part of that sort of state of mind that I was ready to discover photography in. And the third element that really, I think, was an ingredient that resonated with me was I'd always liked to make things. I had been drawing and making sculptures and models and just creating things since I was quite young. And I think that combination of that desire to be outdoors, the desire to make things, and sort of a fascination with technology made photography a natural thing to be curious about. And then a whole other line is I grew up in Merced, California, which is 70 miles downriver from Yosemite Valley. And we would often go to Yosemite Valley. And I do remember going in the Ansel Adams Gallery and seeing Ansel's prints and those prints by Carlton Watkins from the 1860s. And they stuck in my mind, even though I didn't really realize they were sticking in my mind.
Wow. So I take it, growing up in a family of deer hunters, you decided to shoot landscapes instead of...
Well, I always wish them a great trip and hope all of the animals get away and that they come back with really great feelings about having spent time together.
I think you answered this question, but I guess for you, there never was a choice. Once you decided you wanted to take pictures, you focused on the landscape instead of portraiture or news photography, or did you ever do portraiture or news photography?
Well, I was the photo editor for my college newspaper in junior college. I also did a lot of rock and roll because it was just so fun to take pictures of rock and roll kinds of scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So I still use those because I donate them for auctions like Neil Young's bridge concerts and things like that. We did the big prints for the raffle last year from photographs I made in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
I really got involved in photography probably a little bit before the summer of junior college because of the fact that my first girlfriend dumped me and left me with her camera. And I think in trying to get through being dumped, which I'm not ashamed to admit happened, I picked up the camera and started using it. And ironically, some of those early photographs from my dumped girlfriend's camera actually made it into my second book, the book on the Central Valley, just from those early wanderings around the foothills of Merced to Mariposa transition of valley to foothills.
So that's a way to get over a broken heart.
Well, I don't know if you ever get over a broken heart. I think sometimes I carry broken hearts with me all the time. I certainly carry emotion very close to the surface. And I think that was one of the other things that surprised me about photography, is that it became a vehicle for communicating emotional responses. There's something of that in any art form.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not about reaching for our sense of beauty, it's probably not worth doing at all. And in our sense of beauty is both inspiration and heartbreak, because I think beauty has that double-edged quality. And in that sense, whether it's a Sebastian Salgado gold miner in almost slave conditions in South America, or it's a spectacular landscape of a place that we can't resist thinking is the most beautiful place on earth. There is an intrinsic beauty in both of those kinds of photographs.
Mm.
And that's what I'm looking to really encourage people to keep in the forefront of their mind and be a little less fascinated with the technology and more fascinated with the photograph. The technology is great, but photography is far more interesting than the technology that enables it. Also, in that same period of time, I took a college in the AV lab of the junior college and work study in the video lab, and I was copying slides and helping with video productions and basically developed color film before I ever developed black and white film. And at the same time taking a basic black and white photography course that I ended up being a TA for and designing their new lab all within about a year and a half.
You've written in your new book, Stephen Johnson on Digital Photography, that you're driven to create photos that further our understanding about the importance of preserving wild places. Why do you prefer the digital medium for this as opposed to film?
Well, photography for me and being outdoors becomes synonymous with caring about the places that I'm wandering in. And so that instinct to try and find a way of giving back and have the photographs do some good for those places that are endangered is a very natural instinct. And I got involved in that kind of use of photography even in the late 70s when I put together an exhibit on Mono Lake called At Mono Lake that was a group of work that gathered 50 different photographers together to try and call attention to a place that was dying because Los Angeles was diverting water 300 miles to the south. That's how I got to know Brett Weston and Ansel Adams and a lot of people that ended up helping me in my career in lots of ways. The digital aspect of it, it's not so much that I prefer digital to film for conservation kinds of issues. I never purposefully make a photograph as an act of conservation statement. What I do is I go out into these places and inevitably at one level or another I am seduced by the places and hopefully I make strong photographs and then I'm very aware of the context in which that they might be used to further the cause of conservation. What has happened with the very high-resolution digital work I've been doing since 1994 is that this shock I got about how good digital could be when put into a view camera, in a large format camera for photography, is that it became clear to me that I was making photographs of a resolution, of a clarity, of a dynamic range, and of a color accuracy that were really unprecedented in the history of photography. And with my instinct toward landscape photography and conservation issues anyway, it immediately came to mind that this almost demanded that I try this in the national parks. It's interesting that the history of landscape photography has been tied up so much with the history of the evolution of the national park system. It was Carlton Watkins' photographs from 1860s that were shown to Abraham Lincoln and the Congress that resulted in the Yosemite Act of 1864. And it was William Henry Jackson's photographs of Yellowstone that were largely influential in creating Yellowstone as the first national park, founding the National Park Service. And moving on from there, we have Ansel's work in the 30s for Sequoia and Kings Canyon. And again, landscape photography has been used as a tool to portray these places in a way that really helped their preservation. And it just became a call to action at some level that this was a natural thing to try and do. I knew it would be very hard and in many ways impractical, and so that appealed to me for reasons that it would probably take a psychiatrist to figure out rather than a casual interview. But that sense of the challenge of it as well as the promise of it are things that I generally find irresistible.
For those of us that would like to improve our digital photos, what are the top five tips you can give us, Stephen, and maybe even just focus on landscape photography?
Well, ultimately, photography and making it strong is about how you see and how you simplify and how you distill this big, wild, wonderful, sometimes disturbing world into this little tiny frame that we then hold on to and try and hope that we communicate something to someone else. So the primary thing I would talk about would be to make sure that the compositions you are putting together are really what you intend.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the digital technology does allow that's so wonderful is you've got a screen on the back of the camera and you can look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And not only can you check for technical things like exposure, but you can look to see that, in fact, you made the photograph that has a reasonable semblance of what you had in mind. And usually that means, in terms of compositional sense, to simplify, pay attention to design, to keep in mind that photography does not record objects, it merely records light, which means a shadow is as real as a human, and that we need to really look at that balance of lights and darks and design and line as much as we look at what it is we might be thinking we're photographing, because ultimately all we are photographing is that light and dark and line. And so thinking about the aesthetic aspects of a photograph, to me, is the most important suggestion I can make to anybody in any aspect of photography.
I like the tip of just looking at the back of your camera and seeing
what
you're
taking. Well, people deride that, Sarah. It's even got a nickname called chimping,
mm-hmm.
where you look like some sort of ape if you happen to look at the back of your camera and inspect what you've done, as though you're doing something in a sort of Pavlovian dog reaction rather than a natural curiosity about what you've done. But I think it's one of the single strongest aspects of this new adventure in digital imaging that we're on, is that you've got the opportunity for instant feedback. And if you don't use it, I think it's almost nuts. And so the technical aspect of that with regards to exposure and contrast and things like that are important as well. But composition is the main thing I want people to be asking themselves about.
I know you have very strong views about photo manipulation, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Sure.
And your view, where is the line drawn between presenting the best possible image, the best photograph, and a doctored photo that truly distorts reality?
Well, I think the age that we're in is a curious one, because most of us that are at all fluent with the culture are quite aware that photographs can be manipulated into outright lies. And to a large degree, that's a healthy notion for us to have, and a democratizing aspect of the advent of digital photography on a wide scale. Because if we're all aware that it can be done, it creates in us a mistrust when we see things that maybe we shouldn't believe that we're being told we should believe, whether it's political or social or whatever the context might be. That skepticism, I think, is important. But I do think, despite that skepticism, that we are still very much in an age where when we see a photograph, we do instinctively believe that if it is a photograph, it is something that was before a lens. It was a scene that was recorded from the light reflected off of the objects that were before the lens. And given that, we've still got a lot of ground to lose before that notion of the truth of a photograph is truly lost. I think if you were to talk about absolute terms where you cross the line or don't cross the line, it's easy to say if you take anything out of a photograph or you put anything in, you've now made it into something other than a photograph. You've made it into some sort of composited image. Where there's all sorts of gray areas, and it's very hard to sort out, is how much image editing you do that turns it into something else as well. I think it extends to all those things that we think of as being records of the real world, whether it's the record of a beautiful park that, in fact, has been so distorted that it becomes something else. Let me give you a good example of that. I was standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon one day, and it was one of those hazy days that the light was strange and it was hot and it was just not a comfortable place to be. But, of course, the canyon was fascinating, although it's hardly stereotypical. And I watched these people get out of a tour bus, walk up to the edge of the canyon, and one of them says to the other, "It doesn't look anything like the postcards," and they just turned around and left. And so I think we've come to a point in our own history where photographs of places are seen as what the places are rather than for what the places actually are. And that's understandable to a degree when we haven't been to those places. But then when we go to the real scene and are disappointed because it doesn't look like the melodramatic photograph, that says, I think, a great deal about our appreciation of the natural world, about cliches, about sort of formulaic golden light so that every photograph looks like it had to be made in a sunset or it isn't of value. and all sorts of things about what we choose to think of as beautiful and nuance of differences of things that I think are important to notice, and the vicarious versus the real.
Right. Well, that brings me to something else I wanted to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've been all over the world taking, you know, incredibly beautiful photos of the landscape in places many of us never will go. But if you had to choose one photo, which one is your favorite?
Can't do it. Two easy ones are probably places that I'd spent some time just watching the day pass. The bluff I was on at Kenai Fjords National Park, where we walked as far as we could walk up the mountainside and said, well, this looks like a great place. Oh, but what about that bluff, another 200 yards? And we walked up that other additional 200 yards to that bluff and literally stayed up there 5 hours watching the fog come through, the rain come through, the sunshine come out. And it yielded some photographs that were just very special to me of the ice and the glacier and that flow of form that has all of that kinetic energy that is really moving so slow that we don't see it moving at all.
One last question. What is the immediate future going to bring, do you think, in advancements in technology?
Well, I think in terms of photographic technology, we're going to see a greater integration of other kinds of technology into the photograph, so it makes it an ever more connected image to other kinds of metadata. For example, I'm lobbying very hard to have GPS chips built into cameras so that we'll know where the photographs were made. I want spectrophotometers to be in there so that we know the quality of light that was associated with that moment. Inherent in both of those things is additional verification that the photograph was made at a particular time and place. So the very veracity of the image as a piece of evidence also increases. There's all sorts of things along those lines. So just integrating existing technologies can make it an even richer experience of what a photograph can be.
And then it would make it harder to doctor a photograph.
Makes it much harder to doctor it as well.
This is the book that celebrates your career. And why did what prompted you to write it? What did you hope readers would get from it?
The motivation for putting the book together in the way I did was to largely try and make the journey of photography into this digital age be a journey that was a human journey as well as a comprehensible technological journey that ultimately concentrated back on what photography is about, which is the communication of beauty and emotion and reaction to the world that we're in. And so in that sense, if I just made it about Photoshop, I wouldn't have written it because I just don't care that much about a piece of software to write a book about it, no matter how much I care about using the software. And I had seen a state of education start to evolve in this digital photography age where people were teaching Photoshop as though it were a college-level photography class, when in fact it's merely a piece of software rather than a medium. And I was approached about doing the book, and it just seemed like a natural thing to talk about how I had been teaching digital photography for the last 17 years, which is about being photography primarily, about the freedom that the new tools give you, the responsibility that an understanding of the ethical compromises engender, and at the same time, talking about aesthetics and heart and empowerment and some of the nuts and bolts of business and publishing and copyright and labeling and just that whole big picture of what photography is to work in photography today.
What it's like to be a working photographer.
Yeah, and some of the historical stuff that led to the electronic cameras is just so fascinating that it deserves its place in photographic history right along with the evolution of film, whether it be the development of Kodachrome, flexible film, wet plate collodion, the daguerreotype, the tintype, all of those pivot points in the history of silver-based photography really are no more important to us today than the invention of the pantelegraph in the 1860, which was the first transmitted electronic image, and or the digital panoramic camera that landed on Mars in 1976 from the Viking lander. Those are pieces of our photographic heritage now that are startlingly, obviously connected to today's technology but largely unknown. I always talked about autochromes as a color photography process, which was dyed potato starch grains in front of positive black and white film that made for the first color plates in the 1920s.
So I take it you wrote the book you wanted to read.
Yeah, well, yeah, for sure.
That's great. Thank you.
All right, Sarah, thank you so much for all of the interest and all the help.
Stephen Johnson's new book, Stephen Johnson on Digital Photography, is available for purchase at www.oreilly.com. For other great O'Reilly podcasts, visit digitalmedia.oreilly.com.